Welcome to The Jury Is Out, a podcast for trial attorneys who want to sharpen their skills and better serve their clients. Your co-hosts are John Simon, founder of the Simon Law Firm, Tim Cronin, personal injury trial attorney at the Simon Law Firm, and St. Louis attorney Eric Veith.
Welcome to another episode of The Jury Is Out. I'm Tim Cronin.
I'm John Simon.
And John, we have your middle child, your son Johnny, here with us today. Johnny, how are you?
Doing well.
What we're going to talk about in this session and subsequent sessions is a nice little result that you guys got recently. Don't spoil it by saying exactly what happened, but did you guys just have a recent trial with a pretty good outcome?
Yes.
What was the name of the case?
Karen Chaplin versus Trenton Geiger et al.
So, from a high level, what was the case about? What happened?
So, in October 18th of 2020, a 20-year-old kid named Trenton Geiger, who was living at home with his parents, working for Postmates, he was in college, he went to a smoke shop or head shop called Coughing Cardinal, and he bought nitrous oxide, which is otherwise known as Whippets, specifically the Whippet brand of nitrous oxide. He got in his car, he started driving, he inhaled the nitrous oxide, passed out at the wheel, drove off of the roadway and into an urgent care. And standing right outside that urgent care was a young woman named Marissa Polite, our client's daughter, who was struck by Mr. Geiger. She was thrown through the building and succumbed to her injuries about 4 hours later.
She was a nurse?
Yeah, she was a nurse at urgent care, or radiology
tech. Yeah, radiology tech, CT tech.
Okay. If it was just getting off her shift, trying to go home.
12-hour shift.
What time was it again?
8:15. 8:15 in the evening.
How old was she?
25.
Well, that's terrible. Did she pass right away, or was there conscious pain and suffering?
No, unfortunately, she survived for a couple hours. You know, that area of what, was she conscious, was she not conscious, it's always, you know, murky, but there was pretty clear video evidence that she was fighting for her life. Body cam.
Body cam of the police.
And there was also security cameras inside the, it happened in the waiting room at the urgent care.
Yeah.
And they had one camera mounted in there looking out toward the wall where the car had come through. So all of this was on video.
How long between the time of the incident and when they declared her dead?
About 4 hours.
Yeah, 3 to 4 hours.
So the kid went and bought Whippets, got high and drove. So that part, similar to, you know, like a drunk driving accident. And did he drive? Was he on a street like in town? Was he on a highway? Did he drive through a parking lot?
Yeah, so it was in St. Louis County on Clarkson Road, which, if you're not familiar with Clarkson Road, it's a pretty major roadway. It's not a highway, but I think speed limit's about 40 miles an hour. But kind of cuts through a big, like almost like a vein through St. Louis County, like West County. But I think there's two or three lanes in each direction. So he was going northbound, and he immediately starts going southbound. So there were witnesses who were going either behind him or in front of him, and he suddenly like swerved. That's what, I mean, falling asleep or passing out.
Yeah.
It was
unconscious.
It was consistent with him suddenly losing control of the car.
Did he go through any stoplights?
Well, he went through, he crossed over the into the next lane in front of oncoming traffic, up a curb, over some grass, down another curb, up another curb, over some, you know, mulch grass, drove over the top of a small tree, down another curb, up another curb, took out a light post, then went back up another curb, hit Marissa, and then drove her and the vehicle through the wall.
Through the wall.
And the witnesses, the two eyewitnesses at the scene, the first two to arrive, saw him unconscious, behind the wheel, leaning forward with his arms over the steering wheel.
Yeah.
And that's important because one of the issues in the case, one of the defenses was he had simply fallen asleep. It had nothing to do with the
any kind of
substance that he had inhaled. And
or any other substance, which we'll get to.
And the one of the eyewitnesses actually, I mean, they were there. The car was still running. Keys were still in the ignition.
His foot was still,
on the gas. You can hear it on the videotape. And they literally, you know, clapped their hands in front of him a couple times, and he came to. And when he came to, you can see it on the video, he wasn't drowsy, he wasn't stumbling or mumbling, he was very alert. He, you know, and that was one of the, you know, a key piece of evidence was, you know, how he looked and how he acted right after the accident, because it was on videotape.
Yeah. And so this will unfold that his particular conduct was not really the focus centerpiece of the trial, correct?
Not from our perspective.
Okay. Well, that's, I understand. So yeah. To kind of tease it, how much fault did Mr. Geiger, who became intoxicated and drove into your client and a building, how much fault did he get at trial?
10%.
So that leaves 90. What happened after Mr. Geiger was awoken or came to? What did he do before the police arrived?
One of the first things he did was go back. He got out of his car. Then he walked around to both sides of the car, the passenger side, driver's side, and started taking items out of the car. And this was 8:15 at night. It was dark. It was rainy. It's in October. And in front of witnesses, went into the car and started throwing items into the woods. And the woods were behind the building. So he'd gather some things up out of the car, walk about 75 yards, 50 yards to the back of the building where there was a fence and some heavy wooded area behind the fence. And then he was according to the witnesses, chucking
items
baseball style into the woods. And more than one witness, at least two of the witnesses saw what some of these items were, and they included small, bright green canisters of nitrous oxide.
Okay.
Which, if you're not familiar, they look like little CO2, but they're bright green. I mean, can't really.
Were there any left in his car by the time the police arrived?
There were 9 left in his car, 1 empty, 8 full. When the police officers arrived, a couple of the witnesses, you know, told them what they saw this guy doing.
Yeah.
You know, taking stuff from his car and throwing it out in the woods.
They go look in the woods.
Right. And they saw him do that multiple times, 3 times at least, with multiple, you know, items in his hands each time. And so, of course, it's raining. It's dark out. There's a fence, unbelievably thick woods. You can barely stand in the woods. And so one of the police officers started a search of the area where he was, you know, reported to have thrown items out of the car. And his testimony was that he searched an area of about 15 feet wide and about 30 feet long immediately on the other side of the fence from the parking lot. Mm-hmm. So in other words, he didn't go deep into the woods, but he was able to find, even with that limited search, 3 of these, you know, Whippet cartridges.
Found what they were looking for enough that they stopped.
Yep, and exactly. Found what they were looking for and stopped. Now, all 3 of those were empty. All 3 of them.
Okay. Now, it'll become important later. Was there anything else that if they looked further, you guys were saying they may have, they should have also found?
Yeah, Exactly.
So you cannot inhale nitrous oxide from these canisters without something to open them. And they're typically opened in 2 ways. One is with a whipped cream dispenser, which varies in size, can be, you know, 2 liters, can be half a liter.
6 ounces.
Can be 6 ounces. Cracker, and a cracker is a cylindrical device, but essentially there's a head on top of the CO2 canister. You poke the head, the air is compressed, so it kind of spurts out, and you cannot inhale it from the canister because you can get frostbite because it comes out very cold. So what folks who are wanting to inhale the nitrous do is they either use the dispenser and kind of use that as a buffer and just inhale it from the dispenser, or they can get crackers and balloons and pop it open, fill up a balloon, and inhale it. And an issue at the trial was none of those tools were found in the woods.
What, were any of the police officers, did any of them testify by deposition or live?
2 of the police officers came in live. We took depositions of most of the cops who were at the scene. And two we had come in live. And one of the officers was the officer who actually searched the woods. And the other one was the detective that was sort of in charge of the investigation. And so the defendants in the case, you know, were trying to show that it couldn't have been the, you know, the nitrous, the whippets, because he didn't have anything to open it. And obviously they're arguing that these police officers did a great job and searched the entire woods. And the reality was in his deposition, you know, and in trial, he said, look, I spent about 15, 20 minutes searching. It was dark out. I kind of knew what I was looking for because they did give him a description of these small bright green cartridges.
And he found some.
And he found some. But the real key was he admitted that he only searched an area, and this is a parking lot with a fence between it and the wooded area, and he admitted that he only searched an area of about 15 feet wide, in other words, from the end of the fence outward into the woods. And the witnesses all said that they saw the driver, Geiger, you know, throwing these items baseball style. And I think the three actually that they found, probably he dropped them.
Yeah.
You know, I don't...
Yeah. Right, that makes sense.
He didn't go far enough to find the
well,
ones
right.
He
I
would
mean,
have been chucked.
If you're trying to get rid of evidence, you're not going to walk to a fence with a wooded area on the other side and just drop them on the other side of
and
the
what,
fence.
And what witnesses were saying, like he was filling his pockets with stuff. Like he was filling his pockets and his arms and like running behind.
So we'll get into... what Trenton Geiger's position was in the case and admissions he made and stuff like that in a little bit. But when you, Johnny, you first found out about this case here, correct?
Yeah, I found out about this case as I was handling another nitrous oxide case against the same distributor.
Had you had handled a prior case where against United Brands, who ended up being the manufacturing distributing defendant, in this case that we'll get to, in a prior case?
So what I was approached about 3 or 4 years ago by the parents of a young man who was addicted to nitrous oxide. And, you know, their primary concern, like a lot of our clients, wasn't, you know, getting money. It was, how do we put a stop to this practice of selling nitrous oxide?
As a drug.
As a drug at head shops. Well, their son had been going around to head shops all across the state where he was going to college in Kansas City and then back in St. Louis where he moved.
Head shops being stores like smoke shops where you can buy tobacco and then like drug paraphernalia.
Yeah, smoke shops, head shops. I think the
bomb,
terms...
pipe,
yeah,
papers.
Vaporizers, all kinds of stuff.
Okay.
And, you know, he obtained, you know, hundreds and hundreds and hundreds, thousands of these chargers at a time and would sit there doing all because it is... not physiologically addictive, but it is psychologically addictive. I mean, it is an addictive substance. And so I remember the brands, one of the brands he preferred was Whippet brand nitrous oxide. And, you know, it's very distinctive, has a little lady on it holding up a whipped cream dispenser. It's blue and bright green. And, you know, that was one of his preferred brands. And what I found out in that case is that, you know, these distributors aren't even hiding this practice. Like, they're just selling directly to the smoke shops.
So to be clear, nitrous oxide is not per se illegal to sell, like, heroin or...
No,
or
it's not...
cocaine.
So it's such a goofy regulatory issue, but it's not a drug. And it's not classified as a, you know, Schedule One drug like a narcotic or...
Because it has a legitimate purpose other than to use as a drug.
And because this particular nitrous oxide can be used as food grade...
To make whipped cream,
they put it under the FDA regulations, which themselves say you cannot sell this as an inhalant, and if you do so, it's misbranding or it's illegal.
It's illegal, right. And so they claim they're selling it to make whipped cream. Do how head shops, how much sugar and milk do they sell?
Not very much.
Some would say sell the nitrous next to.
So it's bongs and dispensers and, you know, vaporizers and
dispensers.
I mean, all kinds of stuff that
nitrous oxide
crackers, dispensers.
And
in this case, we found out at trial beach balls.
Oh, that's interesting.
Beach balls and other memorabilia.
So of course, everybody has whipped cream with their beach balls, or beach balls with their whipped cream.
Just in case you want to make gourmet whipped cream with your friends.
So you'd handle a prior case where you learned all about this practice of these big manufacturers and distributors, one of the main ones being United Brands. Are they the biggest market leader?
You know, they're not. And there's that was a big point at trial, was that there's other players out there who are doing the same thing.
Maybe not for much longer.
Yeah, hopefully not. But they were... their corporate representative, who hemmed and hawed, but he said, we're about 10 to 15% of the market, is what he said.
So you had taken the owner and corporate representative's depot in that prior case, right?
Yes.
And then you'd got gathered thousands of documents about marketing and sales and all kinds of stuff in that prior case.
So, and there was, so that prior case was in Kansas. It was filed in the city of St. Louis, transferred to Kansas City, Jackson County, and it was a really big fight. But, you know, their position in defense really opened up the discovery in the case to show, like, all right, if they're really saying this is for whipped cream, don't we get to do discovery on that defense and show that it's not?
Yeah, I remember I took a depo in that case.
Yeah, yeah.
They retained a marketing expert, which is a marketing professor at some college.
Business ethics.
That kept saying over and over again, it's okay and ethical because we're selling a legal product in a legal manner. And I think by the end of the depo was admitting, okay, but if you're selling an illegal product in an illegal manner, that's unethical, immoral, negligent.
Criminal.
Like, you shouldn't be doing it. So you had all of this information, and you learned all about this industry from the prior case. And how did you learn about this case, Chaplin, during that case?
So it's really a crazy story. So I was preparing for the deposition of one of my experts in my prior case, and on the news, well, going into the deposition, I learned of this, you know, death, and front page on the news, there's a picture of a whippet. And, you know, one of my experts' opinions was this practice doesn't just cause harm to the user, it can cause harm to the community. I mean, the resources spent cleaning up the discarded, you know, nitrous oxide, the inhalation deaths, the huffing and driving death. I mean,
Emergency resources.
I mean, just astounding. And as he was giving the deposition in St. Louis, the morning of his deposition, he sent me the article and was like, see, this is Exhibit 1. I said, bring it to your depo. And he actually brought it to his deposition and showed it to everybody and said, this is what I'm talking about.
So you reached out to an attorney that was representing that family already on other claims regarding that case.
Yes.
And offered our firm's services to help out.
Well, I brought it to his attention. I said, hey, there's, you know, another aspect of the problem here. I think the original case was filed against, you know, Trenton, his parents, the urgent care for not having
like
the
premises,
you know, because in a case like that, you're looking for, you know, avenues to, you know, compensate your client.
Look for coverage.
Sure. And, you know, in this one, I was like, I mean, take a look at the head shop, you know, where he bought it. And so we were able to get that information. And lo and behold, they were buying it from United Brands.
So was the case already filed at the time you called? And it's Dave Grable, an attorney here in town, good lawyer, who was co-counsel with you guys on the case. Had he already filed the case?
Yes, it had been filed, but not a whole lot of discovery had been done.
So where did you go? Where did you go from there? Did you enter and then amend the pleadings to add who?
I mean, I think that really changed the whole focus of the case because it went from, you know, focusing on this kid. And even though they wanted to call him an adult, and I think during closing argument, you know,
he was
said,
20, right?
Yeah, he's 20. And when you're 20 years old, you're a kid. Rather than focusing on the kid and what the parents knew about the kids using substances, it became the focus on, hey, look at this distributor and this marketing practice of they're making money off this stuff. They're selling it. I mean, he's their target market.
Right.
And so that
in other words, he's kind of a victim too. Not a very sympathetic one based on what happened.
Right. And, you know, I think that's the difference between, you know, my prior case and this case was, you know, in the prior case, I represented the individual who was huffing the substance, which is a major problem. You know, it's almost an insurmountable problem.
And in this case, you were representing the family of the young woman who died as a result of someone else who was huffing it.
And so they were saying Trenton misused the product, just like they were saying, are my prior client was misusing the product, and our burden was to show and prove that he was not misusing it. He was using it exactly as they intended.
So you brought product liability claims, strict liability, negligence, right?
Yes. So we pled strict liability on a design defect theory, which it's very simple. And, you know, I don't know why it's so hard for folks on the other side to wrap their mind around this. It's like selling a poison.
Yeah.
You know, it's not a...
Selling a poison to inhale.
Yeah, and what they were arguing were, and I think this is a gross misstatement of Missouri product liability law, is that, you know, he literally did this in close. He's like, there has to be a flaw in it, like a design flaw. Do you see it? I mean, you can hold it in your hands. I was like, that's not the point. The point is it's the intended use of the product. You're selling it for a use that you know is not intended.
Defective and unreasonably dangerous for its intended use.
And for its intended
reasonably
use.
Reasonably anticipated use.
And
this was the intentionally intended use.
Yeah, right. Right. So let me back up. I assume Mr. Geiger left the scene of this crime and incident in handcuffs with the police.
He did.
So where was he at the time of trial?
He was in prison, and that was a really big issue initially as to whether we could even go forward with the case, because we anticipated that he was going to take the Fifth, and he did.
And he did.
And there was like zero information for us other than through witnesses watching his physical, you know, activity at the scene.
You had to establish that he took this drug and it
yes.
caused him to be intoxicated,
yep.
and this is the reason he passed out.
And you know, all of that without any testimony from the person who was involved in it.
And with two other parties actively trying to prevent you from being able to prove that.
And they had taken the position in pleadings and with the court that we were entitled to no discovery about it until we were able to, like, at least present evidence to the yeah. court that this happened.
So there was a very good attorney in town who represented Mr. Geiger, Tom McGee.
Yep.
Right.
He's from Hepler Broom.
From Hepler Broom. And we're going to talk about the various positions people took at trial and what they said in closing and some things that may have helped you guys out or from one party or another. But at some point, was Mr. Geiger's prosecution over with, where he no longer had to take the Fifth?
Well, we thought so. He pled guilty, and he pled guilty to manslaughter, I guess, what, destroying evidence? Was that
yeah,
the other
tampering
one?
With evidence.
Tampering
with evidence.
I don't know if it was manslaughter.
I think it was criminal negligence, which may be
I thought it was manslaughter.
Another way of saying manslaughter.
But one of the things he did not plea was intoxication at the time, inhaling, you know, the intoxicating substance. Mm-hmm. And I think it was because, I don't know, I'm just completely guessing, but, you know, the criminal case, I think the standard being higher than in the civil case, that they initially charged him with that.
Yeah.
But then it wasn't part of his, what he pled guilty to. And I think for that reason, well, I don't know. I don't know the criminal law aspect of it.
Could still be
right.
Prosecuted.
But when we asked about taking a deposition after he had pled guilty and was in serving his sentence, which is where we took the deposition, I was told, look, he's still going to take the Fifth. There's still some exposure out there.
Yeah.
And that's what happened. We went into the prison to take the deposition. And the main issues, the main questions dealing with the main issues in the case, he took the Fifth.
But there was what I thought was the best question in the case, and it was not asked by myself or my dad. It was by a lawyer for one of the other parties, which was, did you ever use your whipped cream dispenser to make whipped cream?
Yeah.
A brilliant yeah. question, to which he said no.
So, and I mean, the other thing, too, is we did establish things like he did say, I went to the head shop immediately prior to the accident. He admitted to buying a box of 24 of these canisters, the cartridges, and
they were full.
He didn't have any in my car when I left the house. So we could establish through circumstantial evidence, some pretty solid circumstantial evidence. You know, he bought 24 filled cartridges. They find him in his car with one empty and three empties in the woods. And by the way, the one empty that they found was in the driver's side door compartment
yeah.
in the car. So, we had enough, but it's just
between
always
buying them at the head shop.
Yeah.
Accident. Yeah.
But, you know, the thing of it is, it's just one of those things you just want to nail down. And it made me nervous to have it hanging out there because, you know, some people need absolute proof on things,
yeah.
as we all know.
I mean, you have, if absent the ability to establish the link in that chain, you don't get to the other defendants
at all.
So the other defendants were who, Johnny?
So the name of the head shop where he bought the whippets from was called, aptly named, Coffin Cardinal. And then the distributor defendant was United Brands Products Design Development and Marketing, Inc.
So three defendants at trial.
Yes.
Assessment of fault between three defendants.
Yes.
You had all of this information already from your prior case, really everything you needed to know about United Brands.
That's correct.
You had to first figure out how to establish this link to get to the product claims.
Yes.
And John, I understand you went to the prison to take Trenton Geiger's depot.
Yes.
And had you already taken the police officers and the witnesses at the
Yes, we started out by taking all of the police officers. I think we took six or seven of the police officers and, you know, kind of piecing it together. One of the things that was pretty helpful was, you know, they all had body cameras. Mm-hmm. They all had a pretty good record. I mean, who forgets something like this? You know, car and, you know, driving through a person and through a building. And, you know, typically a lot of times you'll take a police officer's deposition a year and a half later, and they're you know, looking at the police report, trying to figure out what they've written. Not on this one. I mean, everybody, hands down, was, you know, remembered every aspect of it.
So you developed all this circumstantial evidence. You go to the prison to take the deposition. Did he plead the fifth on everything you asked him?
No.
Or were you allowed to ask things that really kind of all pointed the arrow at he did it without the direct
You know, question? It was the closer we got to the main issue is, you know, the less, you know, response we got.
Yeah.
But just about everything other than actually inhaling is what as soon as we got to the point where did you inhale, I think, as I recall, even on questions about whether he inhaled previously at any time, whether he used it as an inhalant.
Whether he had any medical issues.
Medical issues, right, and those things weren't answered.
Now, you still get to ask him.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And he pled the fifth, and for him, there's then an inference that the answer's bad for him, right?
Correct.
How does that work for the other defendants? Are they beholden to that adverse inference as well?
You know,
this didn't end up mattering by the end, but we'll get there.
You know, there's not a lot of great case law in Missouri about it. There's some federal, a line of cases developed in federal court that, you know, there's like a three-part test, and I don't want to say it wrong, but it's like the Labuti or some test from the Second Circuit that has kind of taken over at least the federal case law, and it has to do with whether the interests of the parties are aligned, and if they're not aligned.
The interests of these defendants were not aligned.
You know, our instructions say if a party admits something, it is binding against the party. I mean, so that's all I could really say.
And if they plead the fifth, and we haven't gotten to an admission yet, we're still at the plead the fifth.
Yeah.
If he pleads the fifth, the jury can presume his answer about whether he inhaled nitrous oxide while he was driving is bad for him. But I imagine the head shop seller and then the manufacturer distributor were saying, we're not beholden to that.
Sure.
You still have to prove a causal connection.
As it concerns us.
As it concerns us.
Mm-hmm.
And wasn't there an argument for most of the way through the litigation, you can't do that, you're never going to be able to do that?
Through trial.
Nonsense.
Yeah, through trial. I mean, it was really, I mean, there was a hard stance taken in opening by United Brands that there will be zero evidence of a lot of things.
Well, on this one, wasn't that kind of a tough pill to swallow, given that what happened with Mr. Geiger regarding admissions by the time you got to trial?
So in Missouri, we had to file a motion for leave to add punitive damages against all of the parties, including Coffin Cardinal and including United Brands, which we did. And our second amended petition that we filed, you know, I think Mr. McGee was put in a tough situation because he is not Trenton Geiger. He has to file a pleading with the court. Mm-hmm. And so he was required as an officer of the court to admit a lot of our allegations, which included he inhaled the nitrous oxide and that caused him to pass out, which was his answer. That doesn't waive the Fifth or the Fifth Amendment protections of Mr. Geiger.
Client.
Because Mr. Geiger's not signing that pleading.
But as an officer, his legal representative didn't have a good faith basis to dispute it.
Correct.
And so that's binding to Mr. Geiger, but it's also evidence for you for your claims against the other defendants.
I mean, it put him in a position of saying, you know, Mr. Geiger isn't admitting it. Mr. McGee is not telling the truth. And I think during open, didn't he say, I can't speak on the motivations of that, to which, you know, Tom objected as if there was some ulterior motive.
I mean, it would be something, I think, I can't even comment on that, or I don't know why he said that, but
It kind of implies that you guys struck some kind of
exactly,
but didn't.
But here's the thing, too. You got to look at it in the context of the other evidence.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, he wasn't throwing bales of marijuana out of the car. He was, you know, the first thing he does, well, you know, first of all, he passes out. There's no question he had passed out. He didn't fall asleep.
Yeah.
Just based on what he went through, and, you know, they find him behind the wheel still unconscious.
It's undisputable he had just bought these things.
Right. He just bought them.
It's known
that they can cause you to lose consciousness.
And rapidly regain consciousness.
And rapidly regain, and he's coherent and not, you know, sleepy or tired or high afterwards at the scene.
I mean, as you can imagine, folks were right in his face, too, like talking to him with body cams.
Yeah, I bet.
And the other thing, too, is, you know, what is his first? I always thought that even though it was circumstantial evidence, I thought it was as strong as it could be.
The first thing he did.
Right. What's the first thing he does? He gets out of that car. And he starts gathering up the Whippet cartridges and tossing them as far as he can out into the woods.
I mean, I think after the police officers took the stand, that issue was done.
Now, you mentioned not tossing bales of marijuana, and you mentioned that for a reason. Didn't United Brands try to point the finger at other substances?
So Trenton got blood tested, obviously, after doing this. His blood came back positive for two substances, one and not nitrous oxide, which I can explain in a minute why that is, marijuana in a really high amount, and venlafaxine, which is Effexor. It's Effexor. It's an antidepressant.
Okay.
Which they falsely claimed was a psychotropic drug, like just implying that he was abusing his medication without basis. Mm-hmm. But he was prescribed that by a doctor, and you know, because he was depressed, 20-year-old depressed kid, not really knowing where he is in life, living with his parents, coming home from college, and, you know, finding a way to escape with nitrous oxide. But, you know, nitrous oxide wasn't in his system because it is never in your system if they don't blood test you within about 30 minutes of inhaling it.
So it didn't show up, but that's not surprising.
Well, they did actually send a sample of his blood to an out-of-state lab that specialized in testing for nitrous oxide. The accident happened at about 8:15. Blood wasn't drawn until about 4 a.m., about 8 hours later.
Yeah.
And they still fought to try to get the negative test in when, you know, it was meaningless.
To mislead the judge.
Right. And we fought about that and ended up, I think the judge made the correct decision.
Yeah.
And that is, well, if you admit that it wouldn't have shown anything anyway, what's the benefit of, you know, waving around a negative, you know, test?
But they wanted to point at another drug, right, Johnny?
Marijuana.
And so how did they try to do that, and what did you do about it?
So he, in his possession in his car, was a whole bunch of marijuana paraphernalia.
There was no dispute he was a regular marijuana smoker.
Well, I mean, there was no evidence of it. So, you know, we tried to keep it out for the simple fact that marijuana is a way different drug than nitrous oxide. Marijuana, chronically, it builds in your system.
Yeah.
And, you know, there's a whole lot of controversy out there. So the per se limit in, say, Illinois across the river of marijuana that you can have in your blood, where if you're stopped and you have this amount in your blood, you get charged with a driving under the influence. It's 5 nanograms per liter, mm-hmm. which he had 25 in his system. So,
a lot.
But it really might not be that much if he's a
It might not be
heavy.
Acute. He might not have just smoked it.
His baseline. In
his
other words,
baseline.
Yeah. Right. And that's what the experts said in the case. And I thought, I forget which one it was. I thought both of the experts on causation on the marijuana issue did fantastic.
So did you have experts and the other side had experts about that?
So we retained a toxicologist and we retained an addiction medicine specialist, both who gave opinions about why nitrous oxide, not marijuana, you know, and just very convincingly, because marijuana doesn't cause you to pass out, you know, suddenly, like at the wheel. For folks who are listening who've smoked marijuana, maybe while you're driving,
which we do not endorse.
Yeah, which we do not endorse. But I mean, actually, the evidence is, and it was not funny reading it, but it says you actually drive a lot safer when you're high because you slow down and kind of chill out and don't take any sudden movements.
Who was the addiction specialist?
Dr. Ignatoff.
Ignatoff. So Dr. Ignatoff, I thought, did a great job. He said, been there, seen everything, you know, hundreds, thousands of nobody passes out too much marijuana.
Well, and you don't pass out without being super sick.
Right.
Yeah. And again, the kid when he was woken up, started chucking nitrogen.
Yeah, cannons. if you've consumed so much marijuana that you are like
he wouldn't need to be hauled out of there
you're vomiting, you're slurring your words, you can't focus.
And yet they wanted to focus on. They had experts trying to point the finger at marijuana, right?
which was they had a toxicologist and a psychiatrist who they ended up not calling because his testimony was ridiculous.
That was
Hannis.
Hannis, yeah,
Dr. Hannis, who. He blamed it was a perfect fit for United Brands, blaming everyone except themselves. He blamed everybody except the party that retained him. It was the prescribing doctor of the Lexapro's fault. It was the police's fault for not doing an adequate search. And he's giving all these opinions in his deposition.
Yeah.
It was the parents' fault for not monitoring their child more closely. It was Trenton's fault. And I was like, doctor, how do you feel about, I don't know, selling a drug in head shops, selling this inhalant in head shops? And he's like, I don't have a position on it. And I was like, excellent.
Okay. Now, they did call their toxicologist, right?
Yeah, they called
him
via
you
video.
Took the toxicologist and the psychiatrist depo that they had to try to talk about marijuana.
Yes.
And you had a motion based on admissions you got in that deposition where there was a lack of foundation, essentially. The toxicology test didn't.
I mean, you
because
can't.
Because it can build up in your system, it didn't mean he'd smoked it and they had no tie to it.
And, you know, outside the context of the civil litigation, when the burden was, beyond a reasonable doubt, they could not charge him with marijuana impairment because the toxicologist did not know his baseline. There was enough doubt because you don't know his baseline. You can't say, based on this level, that he's impaired at all.
The level Correct. Itself, by itself, doesn't tell you anything.
And so I think with their retained toxicology expert, United Brands and Coffin Cardinal retained the toxicology?
It was just United Brands.
Did Coffin Cardinal just kind of take a back seat?
Which is, in my opinion.
Probably the right move.
I mean, in my opinion, the more attention you call to yourself, the worse, yeah. And that in a case like this. But
as it turns out,
yeah.
Which we'll get to. So you moved to exclude the marijuana completely at trial, and the judge initially agreed with you, but then it let it in, right?
Which, probably was the right call.
Well, it means you don't have to worry about it.
Sure,
on appeal.
But it was a huge red herring where, you cannot, if everyone is agreeing that there is no evidence of how often this person uses marijuana, then there is no way to connect up the amount in his system to when he used it.
Right.
So that's the foundational problem, and I think Missouri case law supported that it should get excluded, and it's a developing area of the law. I mean, it's now, back in 2020, it was illegal. In 2023, when we tried the case, it's recreational, and you can buy it.
And I thought that they made a good argument on that issue that, the judge finally allowed it in, and that was, here we are, and, the plaintiff is allowed to get in.
They're saying
evidence of nitrous oxide, and they don't have levels, and here we are. We do know he was smoking marijuana. He admits that he had smoked it,
and we don't have the burden of proof and anything we can put up to try to dispute the plaintiff's claim.
Right, yeah. And I think overall, I can understand the ruling, and it's
I can understand why it wanted to get in. What they should have been thinking about is what is it going to look like to the jury, because it really does. Dr. Marlin, who is our toxicologist, he's out of the University of Mississippi, nice Southern guy, and he said, this is what I call a spaghetti argument. Throw it at the wall and see what sticks.
Yeah.
And I was like, that's really what it is.
The thing I kept coming back to on the marijuana was there was probably a very, very good chance that the majority of our jurors smoke marijuana.
Yeah.
Right.
And have not passed out and driven into an
right, and people
not,
have
not
people,
to make light right. of what happened,
and it's, it's legal now. People have experience with it.
It was in his center console. It was dabbing, and dabbing is a way of smoking marijuana. But I guess the idea is that you heat up. It's in a wax, and you heat up the THC, and that activates it, and then you inhale it, which increases the potency tremendously, which
dramatically increases the potency.
I don't know why anyone would need to do that, but apparently that's what he was doing. That was all found though in his center console. He didn't, throw that in the woods.
Yeah.
It was not what he went for immediately. And I was like, put two and two together. I wonder why he was throwing out the nitrous oxide and not the marijuana.
Yeah. I mean, I think it probably ultimately helped you add heat into the case with the jury, with them trying to point at marijuana. So, okay. So we've talked about what Trenton did, what happened to the client's daughter, and I'm going to ask you to tell me about the clients in a minute, establishing the causal connection that, you know, he had purchased these nitrous canisters from this head shop, and you were able to establish in discovery where that they got them from United Brands, right?
Mm-hmm. Was that it?
Was there difficulty in that in the case?
Originally in the case, I had offered in writing to United Brands to stipulate that as long as I can use the evidence from the Snyder case, I won't do any discovery as it concerns their client.
I was going to ask about that. I mean, that was a regular pain in just trying to use the evidence you already had, which obviously you were going to, they were going to be ordered to give.
Well, one of the motions that I argued was a motion to compel discovery that you had drafted, and the attorney for United Brands talked about how it was overly broad, and it was a discovery motion, and it was motion to compel. And I said, well, Judge, that's interesting, because the documents that we're arguing about are in a box in my office.
Yeah. You had all of these documents already.
Yeah.
Subject to a protective order, but you, that you're allowed to keep custody of.
Yes.
In keeping our client's file.
Yes.
From the prior case. They knew you had them. The lawyer that represented United Brands had eventually come in at some point in the prior case and entered in that case. He knew you had them.
Yep.
And you repeatedly went up to the judge saying, order them to deem them, like, agree they are deemed reproduced in this case, or to reproduce them. And you had to go up over and over and over again, right?
Well,
and
it's
they were ordered and they were ordered and they kept. Then they finally would produce some, but not all of them. And you knew it wasn't the most egregious emails and stuff like that.
And, you know, I mean, we had taken the prior case up to the pretrial through, I mean, we were on the courthouse steps when it got resolved. So, you know, I had created my exhibit list. I had created my hot docs list. I knew what I was going to use with every witness.
You knew where the meat was.
Yeah. And so, you know, when we would do discovery in this case, which I served after they wouldn't stipulate, I served discovery, and it was pretty much
the exact same discovery request.
You know, pretty much. I mean, the identical discovery. I think
we didn't even need them to produce anything.
No,
he said we already have them.
They're deemed produced.
Right. So, you know, we're sitting there and we're like, I mean, why can't we just agree to use these documents? And so
clearly the court is going to let you do it.
I mean, because we know what's in there, right? It might have worked had they had a different lawyer who didn't have all the documents.
Especially not producing all of them, knowing we have the rest of them.
And so we get through the first round of discovery, and there's all kinds of objection. I mean, they had been sued, and what we were able to show is that they had been sued in 2012 in a case called Jason Starn versus, 100 head shops, including United Brands. They limited their discovery response to 3 years as if that case doesn't exist. And I mean, having conversations when you know what it was out there makes the discovery conference a lot shorter and a lot more interesting.
Why isn't this email from your marketing director to the CEO in your production?
And I guess warn is not the right word, but I cautioned them that, because of your stipulation, I mean, this is no holds barred. I'm going to ask for much, much more, because I know I used it as an opportunity to make the case.
Because they wouldn't enter the stipulation you proposed, you then sought more discovery than you got before.
Sure, yeah.
So how many motions to compel sanctions did you have to go up and argue before the St. Louis County judge?
I think there was about 6 motions to compel.
And correct me if I'm wrong, your judge in this case was the same judge that had overseen the criminal case about Trenton Geiger.
Absolutely. He oversaw.
He knew all about it.
He knew all about the facts, the issues, the parties involved. And I think, and we all have biases, but he also, you could tell that Trenton, this 20-year-old, kid who was an honor student in the choir, he wasn't the court's typical criminal defendant who he sentenced. And the judge made a point every time we were up there to indicate, he said it more than once, that Trenton, and I find this hard to believe, I don't handle any criminal stuff, but that at sentencing, very, very rarely does the defendant say anything. They just sit there silently and don't say anything and accept their sentence. But he said Trenton gave like a very moving, memorable, speech to the family about, I know you hate me and will hate me forever, that you'll never forgive me, but I'm very sorry for what I did. And, I will never like know the pain that I've put you through, but I hope you can find it in your heart to forgive me. And so, I mean, the judge, it was kind of interesting, was figuring out, okay, who was the problem? You know, who was the problem in this tragedy?
What happened to this kid?
Yeah, who was the problem? And, you know, we figured out, but your original question was, you know, was the issue about United Brands selling this particular nitrous to Coffin Carl, was that an issue? They had produced, and maybe this is, you know, laziness on their part, they had produced a stipulated list of items that they sold directly to Coffin Cardinal in a spreadsheet from my prior case. But yet the invoices that we got in this case didn't really match up to what's on the spreadsheet. So that came out during trial, is that they had produced these redacted invoices that kept off the quantity, and then, but not really the whole quantity, just like the list on the right where it says quantity, the number of boxes, but you could tell, well, there's one of these, one of these, one of these, one of these on, you know, May 15th, 2017, but yet on the entry of the spreadsheet, there's only two listed. So how does it match up? It doesn't match up. And so that came out in the middle of trial, but also that the invoices said things like beach balls that the spreadsheet didn't account for. So that came out in the middle of trial too. So
they had been dishonest in the prior stipulated spreadsheet or in the invoices or both?
Kind of both.
They're hiding sales.
I wouldn't say, you know, I would just, you know, give them the benefit of the doubt.
Yeah.
There were inconsistencies in the documents that they gave us. Their summary of the document didn't contain all of the information.
While they're contesting what you brought up is
that they even sold it.
That they even sold it to Coffin Cardinal, because what they said was, the spreadsheet contained a year's worth of sales.
And did Coffin Cardinal say, yes, we bought this from them?
Coffin Cardinal said, we bought it from them. We didn't buy it from anywhere else.
Yeah.
How did we, you know, have it still after a year and a half of not buying anything, 2 years? I guess we didn't sell as well as we thought it did.
And that was, remember that issue came up in one of the depots, the Coffin Cardinal depots, where, and that was a real turning point in the case where They took the position that they didn't.
Coffin Cardinal. Yeah.
Coffin Cardinal took the position, we haven't sold any of this in 2 years.
No, what they said in sworn interrogatories was, and this was the benefit of having handled the prior case. So in the prior case, I had sent a private investigator to non-party head shops just to get some evidence of how these transactions work, how they're sold. Because my client was like, you walk in, you say, I want 600 nitrous oxide chargers.
And a cracker.
And a cracker. And they go, can I get you some balloons with that?
Yeah.
Or I'm going to a party, can I get 24 of those?
Your prior client.
Yeah. Yeah, man, be safe. You know, things like that.
Didn't you had investigators go either in the prior case or this case go buy some.
Yeah, in the prior case and in this case at trial. But
we're going to talk about the investigator at trial. We're going to save that one.
So Coffin Cardinal sends me interrogatory answers that says, we've been sued before, but you know about it. It's the Snyder case. We stopped selling, you know, nitrous oxide at our store in 2019 after we were sued in the Snyder case. And I didn't have a way to prove that they didn't do that. And so we were in this conference room, I think, and we were, the other one, we're thinking about, there's got to be a way to show that, like, we know it's not true because Trenton bought it from there in 2020. We know it's not true. How do we show it? And I was sitting, I think, having a beer on my couch on a Friday night after, no, I took, it was after I took the CEO's depot, the corporate representative. I went all day with a guy not answering questions and telling obvious untruths. I guess I can say.
We're good. We'll get to that.
I remember it because I was sitting there, my kids are screaming. And I was like, I know I sent an investigator to Coffin Cardinal. I think he bought Whippets. I think he bought the same brand. And so I pull up my laptop where, like, my kids are getting ready for soccer. I'm like, I have to figure this out. And I watch the video and, like,
this is your video of your investigator from your prior case.
Right.
Going to the same head shop as in this case.
Same head shop.
At this, around the same time period. That this
3 months. 3 months.
No, no, before, yeah. No.
The month.
The month. It was August.
August.
So it was August 28th. So, like,
what did the video show?
He goes in. He asks them, do you guys have any cream chargers? Or no, he goes, y'all have any Whippets? Yeah. And they're like, oh, cream chargers? Yeah, we have those. goes to the back and pulls out from a pile of Whippet brand nitrous oxide that's stacked up like this and holds it up. And I froze it and I zoomed in and it's the same box, same quantity.
With United Brands logo on it.
With United Brands logo. And I immediately
produced it.
And they put this man up for a deposition, the corporate rep of Coffin Cardinal. And he swore under oath, we didn't sell it. We stopped selling it. And I pulled out the video and his jaw just dropped. It was like he's looking at his lawyer like, what did you do to me? He's like, clearly I was mistaken. The thing I told you was not true. It was actually false.
I didn't say that knowingly.
Looks like we were selling it, I guess.
Yeah.
And there went that issue. So
I mean, that's pretty important. Otherwise, you can't tie in
right.
Product,
you know,
defendants
especially
at all.
With no direct evidence of, you know, we're trying to put it together with circumstantial evidence to begin with. And you know, and part of it was at that point, I think, had we taken Geiger's deposition at that point, we didn't even have information that he didn't buy it from somewhere else.
Right.
And we didn't have his we needed information from him as to where he bought it.
And that became United Brands' like last point was Coffin Cardinal must have bought it from somewhere else because we didn't sell it to him.
But Coffin Cardinal was saying that's the only place we bought it.
Yeah, Coffin Cardinal was like, look, we go to the distributor. We don't go to a middleman. Why would we do that?
So before we get to leading up to trial, were there any other major hiccups, problems, speed bumps in the discovery workup, the case, where you that other things you had to tie up to even be able to make a submissible claim against the product defendants, Coffin Cardinal, the retailer, and United Brands?
I think the one thing that was a real turning point was getting some admissions from Geiger in his deposition, you know, that he bought it that night, that he bought it from Coffin Cardinal, that he had gone there, what do you say, five times before.
So I agree. I think that was the turning point, was establishing exactly what he was doing before, that he did buy it from Coffin Cardinal, that he did buy a fresh box, that he didn't have any in his car.
All the circumstantial evidence you were able to get from Trenton Geiger in his depo that he wasn't pleading the fifth about.
Yes.
And then your video that you had, Lee, from the prior case where Coffin Cardinal was selling this stuff during that month.
Right, and that they only got it from United Brands. That was, it locked basically Coffin Cardinal in. I mean, Coffin Cardinal looked ridiculous. Another fact that made the case a lot better was that he admitted not only to going that night, but going 5 to 10 times in the last 8 months. So it wasn't like a single sale, because, you know, you can might be able to forgive a head shop for making a single sale to a 20-year-old at 8 p.m., of enough nitrous oxide to make, you know, 40 cupcakes like that. No, maybe one off, but the kid had been there 5 to 10 times in 8 months. He's going on a monthly basis buying nitrous oxide. Like,
Let me ask you this. How much of this stuff was the retailer, Coffin Cardinal, the head shop, selling?
So, and that is, they produced no documents and said, we have no evidence of how much we've sold. Like our point of sale system.
Like they have no documents.
But no documents.
But the video that month showed like stacks several feet high.
And that they weren't, their explanation was, you know, if it's true, I guess that's the truth. It made them sound really silly.
Yeah.
They start selling another brand of nitrous oxide that sold way better.
Oh my goodness.
So that was their explanation as to why they still had the Whippet brand on the shelves. And so...
And yet that's the one they went...
Not much of a defense.
No, it wasn't. I mean, if it's true, I mean,
now
kudos to them for telling the truth. That doesn't happen very often.
How much does United Brands sell, which says they're 10 to 15% of the market?
Oh, like how much are they selling?
How many canisters do they sell?
Hundreds of millions.
So they're contracted to sell 150 million a year. And have been for the last 5 years. Before that, it was $80 million a year. So they doubled what they had contracted to sell. So that tells you kind of where their position. They wanted to downplay and make themselves sound like.
And they were trying to say we sell it for industrial like restaurants.
But
you got lists of their customers, right?
So and that was another big turning point in the case, which would not have happened. I made an offer to not do discovery as it concerns their client on the condition that they stipulate we could use the documents.
And they refused.
They refused, so I served an interrogatory that said, please list all head shops or smoke shops that you've sold to in the last 10 years.
In the St. Louis area or anywhere?
Nationwide.
Okay.
And so they came up with an objection that became important during the trial. They said, we don't keep that information. You know, we have a list of all retailers we've sold to.
Okay.
And so they listed all the retailers.
Based on the names, I think almost all of them were...
Was it like a smoke shop?
Thousand different...
Six to 800 or something?
I think it was an A to Z list. I meant to do that before trial.
It was 40 pages.
It was 40 pages of...
Did you stand in front of the jury and read them?
A lot of them.
Tim, to the point where I was like... Enough.
Dad, sit down.
I was like,
well, no, wait a minute.
They were aggravating everybody. Everyone gets it. Like,
I actually said, let's see if we can find any on this page.
Well, to his credit, the witness.
Can you give me some examples of the names?
Yeah, Choke Smoke, the Studio 420, Mary Jane's House,
the Slut House.
Was there occasional commentary, I imagine, by you, John?
Yeah.
Oh, maybe that one's a restaurant.
Do you think that's do you think that might be a smoke shop?
And we talked about this beforehand, my dad and I. You know, my dad said, this trial has to be like a funeral. I mean, it's a wrongful death case. Like, the evidence sometimes
was the heaviness.
Like, the names of the shops, one was, my favorite was, you know, nitrous oxide is used as a psychedelic drug. And it's a hallucinogen. It allows you to hear things differently. And one of the shops was the Psychedelic Shack.
Yeah.
Which just made, you rolled your eye. Like, come on, man. And, you know, to my dad's credit, when he's reading, I think you did read like 25 pages of it. Yes. It was fast. It was this.
I bet the
Are there any smoke shop? Did you see any smoke shops?
You know, do you think any of those might be a smoke shop?
Yeah. Do you think any might be smoke shops? And she was saying, no, I can't tell. And what I think her testimony was, I don't know what a smoke shop is because I'm not a smoker.
You know, I think more than anything, what that did was it showed, because they took the position, this was the entire list of all of the retailers they sold to, it showed everybody, because we went page by page, that's really their business model. I mean, selling to, there weren't many people on, many, you know, organizations on there that didn't sound like smoke shops.
And when you think about it, I mean, and this was, you know, Kevin originated the first case, and, you know, I had talked with him about how to prove some of this stuff. And, you know, originally I was looking at, like, retaining an economist to, you know, interview the market and to see the numbers that they're selling. It's not sustainable selling it to the proper locations. It's not, you cannot sell 150 million of these things if you're selling
it for whipped cream.
You cannot. And so I was like,
that's kind of common sense.
It is common sense. Yeah. And so I decided not to go that route, but it was, you know, crazy because it's purely profit driven, and they have, in order to meet their purchase contract, they have to sell these things. And that is the inhalation market, in my experience, dwarfs the proper market for this stuff, and they had
much is needed to actually make whipped cream.
You don't need this, and that, you know, I was learning
that much whipped cream is needed,
right?
Yeah.
So I tell you what, we're gonna come back next time. I want to hear a little bit more about our clients and a little bit more about United Brands and how you presented that dichotomy at trial, and then we're gonna get into the trial. So for now, thank you for joining us for another episode of The Jury Is Out. I'm Tim Cronin.
I'm John Simon.
I'm Johnny Simon.
We'll see you next time.
The Jury Is Out is brought to you by the Simon Law Firm. At the Simon Law Firm PC, we believe in the power of pooling resources in order to create powerful results. We often lend our trial skills and experience to lawyers around the country to achieve better results for their clients. Our attorneys welcome the opportunity to work with you on your case, offering vast resources, seasoned litigators, and a sterling reputation. You can contact us at 314-241-2929. And if you enjoyed the podcast, feel free to share your thoughts with John, Tim, and Eric at comments@thejuryisout.law. And subscribe today, because the best lawyers never stop learning.